One time, Robert and I stayed at a hotel that had this little lazy river canal that went around it, and you could go out and get on some kind of an inner tube or just lay in it or whatever you wanted to do. But if you got on some floating device, it was just a little, you know, canal. It's 4 foot wide, and you just had a little, somehow they created a little bit of a stream to it, and it just floated around and take you 30 minutes, but you could go all the way around and just lay there and do nothing and just enjoy. It's relaxing. I'm not sure what is relaxing about being on water like that, but it's just, you're there. You know, you do something similar being on a river, but usually those kind of rivers, I've been on one of those that every once in a while has a little bitty dam, and it has a little bit of a rapid and kind of breaks up the monotony. Every once in a while you get to go over a rapid, but the rest of the time you're just drifting along and just going wherever the current takes you, and you just enjoy the day as long as you don't get sunburnt, and you just enjoy because you're just drifting. Wherever that current takes you is where you're going. Now, if you were at sea and you were on a boat and you no longer had power or couldn't control it or whatever, and you were adrift, that would be a little different. You know, being at a motel where you know that anytime you want to, you can step out of the water and walk up to your room, or being on a river that you know that after a few hours you're going to be at your destination, those are pretty relaxing. But if you were at sea and you were adrift and you weren't sure where those currents were taking you, the winds, that would be a different story. Well, you know, life isn't so much that we can just drift and we're going to float around in a circle and come right back to where we started, or that it's a river and that every once in a while there's going to be a little bit of a challenge to break up the monotony, but we know that definite destination. In the sense of a heart being adrift, it would be much more like being at sea and having no way to control where the boat's going. It's the winds and the currents are taking you, and you're not sure what the patterns are, and you're just adrift. That would not be fun. But you know, in some ways, that's what we do in our spiritual lives. We put ourselves in a situation where we drift, and we're not aware that we're no longer in control of the rudder. We're not aware that the motor is not taking us to an intended destination. We're just enjoying. It's not like there's a storm. It's not like there's strong winds and it's made us frightened. But we're drifting along, enjoying life, and unaware that we are way off course. I'm not sure what it would be like by any imagination to truly be, in the space shuttle headed toward the moon. But I can, to a certain degree, imagine it as you have capabilities of looking out and seeing things, that there are a lot of amazing, interesting things, and the journey itself is very exciting. And perhaps you can look out, imagine there is a window in front that you can see where you're going, and you kind of see the moon out there, and you're going, oh, this is great. And you're just enjoying everything. And as at some point, you're looking out the window, and you go, wait a minute, isn't that the moon? You know, and you've just gone by because you're adrift in a wrong direction. That may be the spiritual life there sometimes. That we're enjoying the journey, and at some point we wake up and realize, wait a minute, I'm off course. Well, that was Solomon. That's Solomon. Solomon's life goes adrift. And what's so amazing about Solomon's life going adrift isn't so much that as a person, as a king, that he went spiritually adrift. It's how much he had going for him. That's what's amazing. So we want to look in 1 Kings chapter 11 about a heart that drifts. But really, to get the setting, we have to look at this blessed man of Solomon. And it's in the first 10 chapters of 1 Kings that Solomon is presented as a blessed person. And we've looked through most of this in previous weeks. As we know, As David died, Solomon was appointed to be king. Even though there was a certain rebellion going on, another brother was trying to get it, Solomon prevailed and he was king. That David had made all these provisions to build the temple. David wasn't the man to build it. It would be Solomon, but David had set in place all of this. Solomon began that task, and he builds his palace. He builds the temple. It's dedicated. And we know about his wisdom, that when God said you can have anything you want, Solomon said, you know, I want to have that discernment to judge my people. Solomon had a right perspective. He had a right heart. He was in the right path. And God said, well, because you didn't ask for money, but you asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you wisdom and I'm going to give you money. Because you didn't ask for this, but asked for wisdom, I'll give you this also. So everything that a greedy person might have asked for, Solomon gets, plus this incredible wisdom that he has. But yet, with that, things didn't always go so well. But in chapter 10, we continue to see this abundance of a blessed life. The Queen of Sheba comes to visit Solomon. And you know, she comes out of curiosity. Is this man really as wise as all of this story's about? Is he really as wise as everything we hear about? You know, that this past week with the bowl championship series game that was played on Thursday night, and they do this in every game, the announcers, and if you like that team that happens to be winning when they do this, then you at least tolerate it, if not enjoy it. And if that's not your team, it's really irritating. But they do it all the time, every game that's played. Whichever team is ahead, there are certain players on that team that are just the storyline. And if you happen to watch a game where it shifts and, you know, maybe the first half one team's winning and then it shifts and somebody else takes control, you also see the stardom shift and how wonderful these players are. But so in that game, on Florida's last drive, Tim Tebow, the announcer, just keeps on about Tim Tebow and all these things that he does, and he goes on these mission trips and he does this. And there was some complaints the next day I heard on sports commentators, and I thought, well, I don't know why you're complaining. This is what you guys do all the time. You just build whoever it happens to be in front, you build them up until everybody hates the person almost. And Michael Jordan, I dislike, and I have never heard anything that Jordan does that's wrong. I just got so sick of hearing about Michael Jordan when he was a player. So they have that tendency of doing that. They just build it up. But one writer, evidently, I didn't read it, but on Friday morning wrote an announcement. Tim Tebow has said he will not be returning to the University of Florida. He's going to go directly to heaven. Well, this is kind of the Queen of Sheba. She has heard all this about Solomon. And she says, is this for real? Can anybody be that wonderful? Which we normally know, no, nobody's that wonderful. And as one sports commentator made a comment on Friday morning, said, you know, I don't care how great the guy is. You can't spend 20 minutes with him and your life be changed. Which I guess is one of the announcements that somebody made. But that's not true with Solomon. See, Solomon is that kind of a person. You spend 20 minutes with him and your life is changed, evidently. The Queen of Sheba, she goes there. It says in verse 2 of chapter 10, it said, at the end of the verse, it says, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. In verse 3, Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king which he did not explain to her. When she perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters, and their attire, his cupbearers, and his stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, it was a true report that I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. So here are all these reports of just how wonderful Solomon is. And her disbelief is not just turned to belief. It says, hey, the stories didn't even do you justice. In verse 8, how blessed are your men, how blessed are these your servants who stand before you continually and hear of your wisdom. Can you imagine? I mean, she comes to this point and says, man, anybody that happens to be around you is just so blessed to be, you know, if they're your servant, if they're your slave, what a blessed existence. Verse 9, blessed be the Lord, that is Yahweh, your God. Now, this isn't her God, but how blessed is your God who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel. Because Yahweh loved Israel forever, therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. And it goes on through here and it talks about that she gave him, in verse 10, the last part, she gave all these spices. Never again did such abundance of spices come in as that which the Queen of Sheba gave to the King of Solomon, to King Solomon. And then verse 11 talks about these trees that are brought in, and that the end of verse 12 says those kind of trees haven't even been seen anymore. I mean, all this comes in. I mean, everything that Solomon is a part of is fabulous. He's just blessed. And that's what we've seen in these first 10 chapters. Is Solomon is not selfish. Solomon seeks only to be a great king and do justice for his people. And so God blesses him and blesses him. And in the whole world, Solomon stands heads and shoulders above everybody. And even the stories that are out there don't do him justice. And the rest of the chapter just continues on and on of how he has all of these things. It's just a chapter of everything that was his. I love verse 21 of chapter 10. It says, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None was of silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. So only the finest was in Solomon. You know, and you could look at this and say, well, all of this extreme wealth and power, that's what corrupted Solomon. But see, there's nothing in this chapter that ever suggests that anything Solomon did like that was wrong. It wasn't that he had all this gold, that he had this great palace. That wasn't a downfall. That wasn't a negative thing. That wasn't a greed on Solomon's part. Everything with Solomon is positive. But however, in chapter 11, we see a heart adrift. In the first 8 chapters, it's a heart adrift. Now, a contrast comes. Verse 1 of chapter 11. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, and he goes through all these different people, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. For Solomon went after the Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonites, and after Melcom, the detestable god of the Amorites. Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, on the mountain which is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the detestable god of the sons of Ammon. Thus he also he did for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. 700 wives, 300 concubines. I do not know how one knows the name of 1,000 people. I have 150 students, and if they're not sitting in the same place, I don't know who they are. 1,000 wives. Well, these are not likely that this 1,000 wives was 1,000 love relationships with him. It's not likely that he set out to choose 1,000 different wives. That surely many of these were political alliances. But that doesn't account. You can't make 1,000 political alliances. So even if you say half of them come from that, you still have a ridiculous number. But even in this extreme numbers, which surely was never in God's plan, there's something beyond that. It's even if there's one. The passage goes on and cites from other passages in the Old Testament that you don't do this because they will turn your heart away from God. In Exodus chapter 34, we read of this, where it says that this is exactly what will happen if you do this. In Exodus 34, verse 11, it speaks this warning. And it's not talking about a king in this situation, but it has the same type of thing. Be sure to observe that what I am commanding you this day. Behold, I am going to drive out the Amorite before you, etc. And then verse 12 says, watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land in which you are going, or it will become a snare in your midst. But rather you are to tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, and cut down their ashram. For you shall not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Otherwise you might make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone might invite you to eat of his sacrifice. And you might make some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might play the harlot with your gods, with their gods, and cause your sons to play the harlot with their gods. That's what it's warning. God has told them this kind of things will happen. It's not, it might happen. It's stated that it will happen. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, in verses 3 and 4, it says, furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. This is what happens with Solomon. The passage tells us that his heart was turned. The heart here is not, in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, heart isn't to be understood the way we use heart in the Western world of kind of an emotional attraction. Heart is that seat of your will, your thinking center, your loving center. It's the whole person that he's looking here. And Jesus spoke very much of this in Mark 7, in 21 and 23. He says, from within, out of the heart of men, proceeds the evil thoughts, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, deeds of coveting and wickedness, as well as deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. All these evil things proceed from within and defile the man. That this inner part is what's turned, and that's what sets the course. Infidelity, spiritual infidelity, as it's spoken of here, is very often subtle, as it begins in the hidden depths of a man's heart. See, it's not that Solomon set out to turn against the God. It's not that at one point he said, I'm tired of this, I think I'll go this direction. There's no intentionality to go down this path, per se, as much as he cut the anchor and set the ship adrift without thinking about what would happen. Infidelity is subtle as it's gradual. Notice in verse 4 it says, when Solomon was old. Are we to think that he only took all these wives when he was old? Not likely. This was a gradual process of adding, of adding, of adding, but it had a cumulative effect. Without realizing that he had compromised all these actions, and it led to a devastating outcome. It took years for those compromising actions to add up. And that should be what catches our attention. For us to be asking the question, well, there's not that intentionality to say, I'm not going to honor God anymore. But are there these compromising actions upon actions upon actions? And it comes to that point where there's a devastating outcome. When he was old, for it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away. He was no longer wholly devoted to God. So there was a period of time that he had those wives, which was not within God's design, but his heart wasn't turned away from the Lord. You know, there's something about all this that's so puzzling, because he shouldn't have ever had multiple wives. But twice in this passage it says he turns away from God. He doesn't continue in the path of David. He's not like his father David. Well, where do you find in the stories of David that David was some perfect person? And this is the guy that committed adultery, that murdered one of his top military men, or had him murdered, that he didn't take the appropriate stands with his children and caused problems. David was never a sinless man. And there's nothing in Scripture trying to tell us that David was some righteous, sinless person in that regard. But what David was a person that always sought after God. Were there periods of time when he was, if you want to use the term, out of fellowship? It appears so. Psalm 51. But he returns to God. There's no accounts of David worshiping other gods. He never turns to another god. Does he fail to obey? Yes. Does he ever worship someone else? No. He's always coming back to God. There's that sense of revival within David. David, therefore, is set up as this person, as a man after God's own heart. Not a perfect person. Not that we should look at those sins and say, ah, it's no big deal if you sin. No, you look at David's life. There is a big deal. There are significant consequences. But you look also, he was a man after God's own heart. Solomon is turned away. Notice back in chapter 3 and verse 3. Now Solomon loved Yahweh, walking in the statutes of his father David. And we see here that he sacrificed, but in the high places, and that really wasn't what he should have been doing, but everything points that he wasn't sacrificing to other gods. But it says he loved the Lord. Now we read here, in this chapter, that he held fast to these in love. He loved these wives. There's been a turn of his affection. Now, is there a difference in affection toward God and toward one's wife, towards one's children? Yes, we can use love in a variety of ways, but this text presents it differently. I don't think it's presented that way. His love for these wives is what led to him turning away from the Lord. So the question becomes for us, where are our affections? Where are our affections? what are compromises that we are making that will lead to a devastating outcome? And that's what's startling about this passage, is that it's when he was old. It didn't happen immediately. It's a gradual process. You know, Solomon never officially renounces God. He never says, Yahweh is no longer my God, I'm embracing these gods. Yet his heart was not completely the Lord's. And he no longer followed the Lord in that totality. Verse 4, it says, when it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord. Verse 6, Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not follow the Lord fully. Both of those are compared to David. It changed. And we see the consequence or the reaction of this jealous God we read of earlier, where God is a jealous God. He is an angry God. And we read of an angry God in the next one. So we have a heart adrift. Now we see an angry God. Verse 9, now the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other gods, but he did not observe what the Lord had commanded. So the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, but I will tear it out of your hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. We see an angry God. You know, we have such a hard time in a society like ours of viewing God as angry. You know, anger is just a negative term, you know. I can imagine that with this kind of a, if you read the Old Testament, that there would be people saying, well, God ought to be going to anger management, you know. But this is a God, this anger comes out of righteousness. He's a zealous God. He is God. There are no other gods. And his anger isn't that kind of anger that we so often experience, that I'm angry because I don't get my way, I'm angry because this frustrates me. His anger is that his child is pursuing something that isn't and worshiping something that isn't real in place of him. A jealous God because he loves. We also here notice that it says that the end of verse 9, that God had appeared to Solomon twice. Think about experiences. We live in a time where Christians, in a broad sense, seek experience, and experience seems to be more what control things than truth. And it would appear to me, just in my own estimation, that if God would appear to me, I'd be set for life. You know, if I saw the Red Sea part, that's all I'd need. And it's not true. Didn't happen for the people of Israel, and didn't happen for Solomon. I don't know that there's anything necessarily wrong with that kind of desire. Say, boy, wouldn't it be neat if God appeared to me, or if I saw that miracle. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But if we ever have the mindset that somehow we aren't blessed because this didn't happen, or we would be better off if it happened, we haven't read Scripture. Solomon turned away from the Lord, even though God had appeared to him twice. The next section, we see a sovereign God. A sovereign God. Verse 14 through 26 is really about a sovereign God. In verse 14, then the Lord raised up an adversary to Solomon. Verse 23, God also raised up another adversary to him. In verse 26, then Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the Ephraimite, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruth, a widow, also rebelled against the king. There are at least these three things we see. God's in control. God has said there's going to be judgment, but it's a sovereign God in this judgment. This isn't a history be written after the fact favorable to Israel. This is a sovereign God. But he's a purposeful God also. Verses 27 to 40, we see that he's a purposeful God. It's not just that God is an angry God and therefore he's going to judge and wipe them out. No, he has a purpose. And verses 11 and 12 and 13, if you go back, he said that, you know, his judgment upon Solomon and upon Israel is not going to cancel out God's purposes. And he tells them that this judgment is not going to come now because of my regard for your father, David. And it's not going to be total. So look at verse 12 again. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. But I will do it. Verse 13. However, I will not tear away all the kingdom. It's not going to be now, and it's not going to be total. There's the promise. Even amidst this devastation, God has the right to totally wipe all this out. But God's grace says it won't come now. Not because of your merit, but because of what I think of your father David. And it won't be total. There's the promise that ends here. So as you look at this chapter, there's a heart that's adrift. God comes in with another alteration of the plan. There's going to be a divided kingdom, but he's still going to provide. There will be this remnant. There's a promise. Even in his anger, his grace is always there, and his grace continues. But for us to look at this and say, are we ever in that realm of where Solomon is? Have we ever been blessed that way? Well, spiritually we probably have been, but not physically. And yet, the subtlety of him making choices, his heart was turned away. And that's where we have to ask ourselves the question. You know, what is it? Is there something that I'm making compromises and there's no immediate big downfall? And yet, there will be that day when I'm old and my heart's turned away. Our heart's adrift. You can just imagine if you're on that ship. Now, you know, like I said, if you're in a storm and there's high winds and the sails don't work or the motor's out, and you know right then you're in trouble. Well, let's say you're just out there. Out there and the waves are here and it's a nice day and you're just unaware that the rope or the chain to the anchor broke. Are you really aware you're drifting? And does it really matter at that moment? But one day you wake up and you realize you're a long ways away from your destination. That's Solomon. Where is our devotion? Where's our heart? Where's our affections? And that's a challenge for us all the time. All the time. Will you stand with me as we conclude? Father, we thank you for your blessings. We thank you that Paul pens in Ephesians that we are blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. While we will never have the physical blessings that Solomon had, we are so blessed. More than we could ever ask for or imagine. But Father, help us always to be aware of where our anchor is, and that it is anchored. That we're anchored solidly in a very firm fashion to you. to your truth and that we're not adrift. And we do pray in Christ's name.